Hi, I'm Anna Krane. I'm the research manager at Tech Against Terrorism, an organization that supports the global tech sector tackle terrorist and violent extremist use of the internet whilst respecting human rights. Welcome back to another episode of our podcast. This week, we're discussing extremist manifestos and how they've been used by perpetrators of violent attacks to promote their ideology and inspire further violence and hatred. We'll cover their evolution as a terrorist tactic, different authors and styles, and focus on the role of the internet in amplifying their reach and impact. Manifestos have a long history and are typically used by political organizations to publicly outline their ideology and policy aims. They're used in a similar way by extremists as a way to communicate their motivations, goals, and grievances. Historically, manifestos were typically disseminated through printed materials, letters, or even oral messages. However, in recent times, manifestos have taken on digital forms and can be shared with ease on a wide variety of online platforms, enabling their rapid dissemination to a global audience. Joining us today is J.M. Berger, a writer, analyst, and leading researcher focused on extremism. He's a senior research fellow for the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, the author of four critically acclaimed books, and a research and policy consultant to tech companies and US government agencies. J.M. started by giving me a brief history of extremist manifestos, referencing some of the most notable examples in recent decades.
Manifestos, in a very general sense, have been around for a very long time, hundreds of years, if not longer. They're just a statement of what someone believes and why they believe it. And, you know, until relatively recently, manifestos were mostly political statements. So often very sophisticated political statements that didn't really sort of delve into the personal ideology. Often they were issued on the behalf of an organization, like in the 1970s, you see the Weather Underground or the Symbionese Liberation Army put out fairly elaborate manifestos, but they were like not personal statements. They were organizational statements and they were very highly structured. So starting really, I think you can sort of point to the Unabomber as sort of the start of a more mixed kind of manifesto where an extremist who is seeking to justify specific extremist violence uses the format of a manifesto to make that argument. And so the Unabomber happened. That was a very big event in American culture, leading to the publication of his manifesto in major newspapers around the country in an effort to stop his attacks and what ultimately led to his capture. Beyond that, several years passed, I think, without this really being a big issue on anybody's radar. And what really sort of kicked off the modern era of extremist manifestos was the Anders Breivik attack in 2011. And Breivik, as I'm sure most people who would be listening to this podcast know, killed almost 70 people and left a 1,000-page manifesto behind detailing his arguments for doing so, is very extremely online arguments for why he believes what he believed, you know, with footnotes. And also, and I think this is sort of a key thing that really distinguishes what we're going to be talking about from the manifestos of yore, a very detailed account of what he did and how he prepared to do it. So that manifesto was really just had an incredible impact on the extremist environment, thanks to the internet, thanks to a lot of different factors, and that really created a new kind of genre of manifesto that is a combination of political statement, personal statement, and instruction manual. And I think that's, when we're talking about extremist manifestos today, I think that's really what we're talking about.
In the last 10 years, manifestos have been increasingly used by far-right terrorist attackers. In fact, these documents seem to have evolved into a crucial component of modern far-right terrorism. I asked JM what's behind this apparent increase and whether he feels the internet is in any way responsible.
I think it's a perfect storm situation. So more than anything, I think Anders Breivik's unprecedented success as a lone wolf, genuine lone wolf terrorist acting purely alone, really amplified the effect of his manifesto, which was also an outlier. You know, it was 1,000 pages of densely written stuff, you know, not very compelling in my opinion, but obviously some people have found it to be so. So he wrote a really sophisticated manifesto, and he carried out one of, you know, what is undoubtedly the most deadly lone wolf terrorist attack in history. And those two things together really elevated this form and led to people emulating it. So I would also point to Elliot Rodger in 2014, who I think, you know, is possibly a slightly different strain of manifesto. His was much more personal statement. He was an incel mass murderer. And he left behind basically an autobiography that had his views sort of woven into it. And so those two manifestos really sort of framed what came next. I think the internet did play a big role in this, because in the past, you know, people, I mean, the Unabomber had to threaten to kill people to get people to see his manifesto. I mean, the process of publishing the Unabomber's manifesto was a, for those of us who were alive back then, will remember, it was a gigantic process of negotiation, and it was a very controversial decision to publish his manifesto and to let people see it. And what the internet does is really takes away that gatekeeper. So, you know, within hours of the Utøya attack, Anders Breivik, you know, everybody was reading that manifesto. It was circulating widely online. And, you know, it's what we've seen in subsequent years, the sort of crop of manifestos we've seen, there are, you know, different versions of this, exceptions, but the most dominant sort of strain of we've seen has come out of the Chan culture. 8chan, 4chan, 8kun, kind of very fringe sites where not only are these manifestos posted so that people will see them immediately, but they're also discussed and celebrated. So I think online culture is really, you know, when you go back and look at the controversy around publishing the Unabomber's manifesto and compare it to, you know, what we saw in the mid-2010s, there's just a huge difference in how this information gets out, how it circulates, and how the mainstream media treated it. So Elliot Rodger's manifesto was published in the New York Times, and so this is on their website, not on their newspaper, but, you know, the media has really gone through a lot of evolutions in this process, too.
With extremist actors of different backgrounds and ideologies composing their own manifestos, I wondered whether there were any common patterns, themes, or styles across these documents.
There's certainly some significant variation, but there's also a sort of identifiable strain. So you have some people who are doing manifestos that are kind of distinctive or personal to them, or things that we might not even think about as manifestos. Maybe they feel more like autobiographies, like Omar Hamami and Al-Shabaab, American who joined Al-Shabaab, wrote a fairly extensive autobiography that also doubled as an ideological statement. But there's really kind of a subgenre that is very consistent, and that follows on Breivik and then really is a sort of Chan-driven format in which people, including like Brenton Tarrant, Patrick Crusius, Peyton Gendron, they're actually not only like emulating the style of each other's manifestos, but they're sometimes literally copying and pasting content from one into the next. And so those manifestos have a very distinctive style, and they're much more usually packed with memes and kind of in references. They usually include some discussion of how they planned the attack, and usually referring to something like, you know, along the lines of kind of great replacement theory, which stipulates that non-white immigrants are replacing white people in Western cultures.
So why do these attackers take the time and effort to write and distribute a manifesto?
Well, the manifesto aligns an attack with an ideology. It doesn't necessarily have to be a sophisticated ideology, but it takes a piece of violence that may otherwise seem random and directly attributes it to the subculture. So, you know, to get that kind of sanctification, to get the sort of the Chan culture designates some of these mass killers as saints, literally saints. And that really has to do with a body count, but it also requires some explicit statement tying the attack to the subculture. So, for instance, you know, the Las Vegas, there was a very large mass shooting in Las Vegas a few years back that the shooter did not really leave a clear trail of breadcrumbs. He didn't leave a manifesto. His ideological beliefs weren't very clear. And so even though it was an extremely successful attack from a tactical and casualty standpoint, it didn't gain the same kind of traction. The guy didn't get sanctified, you know, because he didn't leave the necessary information needed to decode the meaning of his violence.
Clearly, a manifesto can influence the impact and the status an attack has among supporters of that ideology. Why is it that some manifestos become highly revered, widely shared, or even worshipped by supporters, while others fade into obscurity?
Ultimately, the most impactful manifestos are impactful because of what the perpetrator did more than what's in the manifesto. So Brenton Tarrant, you know, Anders Breivik, obviously, people who have very high body counts tend to have their manifestos celebrated more. Breivik is really, you know, as far as sort of a stylistic and if you want to call it, you know, literary influence, Breivik is really the central piece of this, with the stipulation that the people who followed Breivik are much lazier. They're not writing 1,000 pages of stuff. They'll write, you know, 20 pages or 100 pages, which is still a fair amount of text in some cases. But, you know, the Breivik style, I think, is really what moves a lot of these people. And, you know, the discussion of the stuff on the Chan boards is pretty detailed and also plays a role in really shaping how these things look and how they get distributed. So, you know, what you see on the Chans is there's a focus on the body count. That is the thing that, you know, elevates one of these people, any of these attackers, more than another one, is how many people they manage to kill. And there's also a lot of discussion about making sure that people see your manifesto. So there was a couple of recent cases where, you know, people wrote manifestos, left them on their computers, and the authorities saw them, but they never got out into the public. So there's a real emphasis in the message boards about making sure that you post it before you go online.
Some far-right terrorists have also live-streamed their attacks, further amplifying their violent worldview.
Certainly the Christchurch attack combined manifesto and live stream in a way that was shocking, but it also was very deadly attack. So, you know, you need all of those elements together. It's pulling off a live stream is difficult, I think. And there are mechanisms in place to prevent that kind of thing from disseminating very quickly, especially after Christchurch. The sort of cost benefit of the live stream is very hard to estimate, but I think that, you know, when someone can successfully pull off the live stream and successfully pull off the attack and leave a manifesto with some substance to it, you know, that obviously is an attack that is going to get a lot more traction in extremist communities than another attack.
By publicizing elements of their manifestos, and sometimes going as far as publishing the documents in their entirety, the media have historically played a role expanding the reach of extremist manifestos. How does the mainstream media report on these attacks without inadvertently amplifying the attacker's ideology and generating fear in society?
I think we've seen some progress on that front. So, you know, I think it certainly after Breivik and the period after Breivik and running up into 2019, what we saw is that media sources would often report pretty extensively on the contents of the manifesto. You know, so what was in the manifesto would get repeated. Sometimes the manifesto itself would be republished, and the claims in the manifesto would often be treated very credibly. So, you know, it's not a manifesto is a statement that is intended to ascribe meaning to an attack, but you can't necessarily assume that everything in the manifesto is true or an authentic sentiment. So for a while, there was a period where this stuff was treated very uncritically by the media, and that where the media really kind of repeated and amplified the contents. And I think it's gotten a lot better over the last couple of years. What we see now is the existence of this kind of text will be acknowledged. Sometimes its contents will be discussed in very general ways, but we don't see the same kind of detailed recounting. I mean, we don't give the person who carried out this attack a platform to spread their views. You know, we just do a much more clinical, like, you know, the user cited the Great Replacement Theory or cited anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and we don't have to get into, you know, a lot of detail about it. What we also saw, I think, in the spate of 2019 manifestos that emanated from the Chan culture is that there was a lot of obvious BS in some of these manifestos in terms of things they said about their motivations or their travel, their contact with other people in a movement. You know, there was a lot of stuff that was clearly untrue, you know, down to the level of, you know, people recycling like the old Sam Hyde meme, which is a meme that extremists and online trolls trot out every time there's one of these attacks. They'll try and, you know, get the media to report that it was this guy named Sam Hyde. And, you know, the media is hip to that now, so they're a little more sensitive to it. But that kind of thing in these manifestos was for a while getting too much traction. You know, with the reporters would either be duped by a joke or just repeat it uncritically without putting it into context. And so I think we see a lot less of that now, too. I think we're in a much better place on this now than we were when I wrote about this in 2019.
Finally, I asked JM what the tech sector should be doing to tackle the online spreads of extremist manifestos. As he explains, although new technologies have aided platforms in removing terrorist content, he's concerned about the impact of cuts in trust and safety teams across the tech sector, and the challenges of moderation on newer decentralized platforms like Mastodon and Blue Sky.
We've seen in the last couple of years, you know, an increasing use of GCT's database technology, which allows tech companies to interdict different kinds of extremist content. It was originally used a lot for images and videos, but it's also can be used for text, including manifestos. So we're seeing, you know, a heightened, what they call a crisis protocol, when something happens to really immediately try and knock this stuff off. Additionally, I mean, up until this year, social media companies were pretty focused on moderating any kind of content like this. They had robust trust and safety operations. What we've seen in the last year is that those operations have been cut down pretty substantially, in large part at the leadership of Elon Musk at Twitter, showing some other companies that maybe they think they can get away with not moderating as much. And then on Twitter itself, there's an ideological decision not to moderate content. So these kinds of environments, you know, we've had all these sort of technological advances that make it easier to interdict this kind of content online, but it only works if companies are willing to do it. So, you know, I think we're to some extent sort of entering a brave new world era where the major techs, I mean, either their content moderation policies are practically non-existent or they're chaos driven. Then secondarily, the other companies are backing away from some of their commitment to this. I think for the most part, where we're seeing the softness in the sector is around misinformation, political misinformation. So I think, you know, I don't think Facebook and YouTube and big platforms like that are going to start loosening up their standards on violence in the same way that they are on misinformation. But, you know, it's very hard to assess how that's going to be going forward. So then the final piece of that is that in, you know, especially accelerated by sort of the collapse of Twitter, what we're seeing is a rise in these federated social networks, which do not have a central authority. And content moderation on these networks is really fragmented and under-resourced. And so it's going to be, we haven't had a real test of this environment yet, but eventually we will see a test in which a platform like Mastodon or Blue Sky is dealing with something going viral in this area and is not able to keep up with it. Mastodon has been around for a while. There's like at least some kind of established patterns. You have some Mastodon servers are fairly well moderated, while others are not. I think Blue Sky, because of the way that Blue Sky has been rolling out, when it goes public, there's going to be some real challenges in sort of moderating that platform. You know, there's one big central Blue Sky platform right now with about 1 million users. And when they go wide, it'll be federated in the same way Mastodon is, which means that, you know, there's no one provider of Blue Sky. There's like a bunch of different companies that give you access to Blue Sky. And so, you know, the federation opens it up to anybody can stand up their own Blue Sky server and then join in the big conversation on the Blue Sky protocol. And so, you know, I haven't seen real good evidence that the Blue Sky team is ready for what that's going to mean in a content moderation standpoint. So I think we're in for a bumpy road. I guess this is a very long-winded way of saying I think we're going to have some challenges ahead.
Thank you, JM, for giving us your time today. Tech Against Terrorism works closely with industry partners to respond to incidents where terrorist live streams and manifestos are distributed online to prevent their spread across the internet. We currently alert tech companies to 5 terrorist manifestos through our terrorist content analytics platform, TCAP. We will also soon be publishing our incident response policy, which outlines how we respond to crisis incidents, alerting attacker-produced content, including manifestos and live streams, to tech companies and supporting existing crisis protocols. For more information, please visit our website, terrorismanalytics.org, or follow us on Twitter at TCAPAlerts. And if you want to learn more about Tech Against Terrorism and our work, visit techagainstterrorism.org or follow us on Twitter at TechVersusTerrorism. Before signing off, I'd like to say a fond farewell to our listeners as I step down from hosting the podcast. Thank you to the wonderful guests we've had and to the listeners for tuning in and allowing the podcast to grow. I'm Anna Kranen, and this is the Tech Against Terrorism podcast. Thanks for listening. But don't worry, we'll be back soon with a brand new episode and a new host. And if you enjoy listening, please rate, leave a review, and share the episode, as that really helps new people find us. This is an OG podcast production. Executive producer is Archie McFarlane. Produced by Adrian Dangor. Edit and sound design by Oli Giyu. Music by Rowan Bishop.